From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. February 1985 is Black History Month. Apropos of Black History Month, Soundings now presents a discussion that traces the life and legacy of Martin Luther King, Jr., whose personal ministry and social activism ended with his assassination in Memphis in 1968, but whose influence continues as a vital force in American life. The Soundings panelists are two of Dr. King's biographers, David Garrow and David Levering Lewis. David Garrow is a professor of political science at the City College of New York. In addition to a forthcoming biography of Martin Luther King, Jr., Professor Garrow is the author of two books about Dr. King, Protest at Selma and the FBI and Martin Luther King, Jr. David Levering Lewis is a professor of history at Howard University. His biography of Martin Luther King, Jr. was published in 1970. Professor Lewis is also the author of A Bicentennial History of the District of Columbia, published in 1976, and of When Harlem Was in Vogue, published in 1981. David Lewis recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a project about Ethiopia, Africa, and the Upper Nile at the end of the 19th century. Here is David Garrow.
Dr. King was born in Atlanta in January of 1929, was educated in the public schools in Atlanta, segregated public schools, of course, at that time, and also was very active in his father's church, Ebenezer Baptist. Dr. King went to Morehouse College, a black school in Atlanta, and graduated from there in 1948, then went to Crozier Theological Seminary in Chester, Pennsylvania from 48 to 1951 and received a Bachelor of Divinity degree, and then went to Boston University where he received a PhD in Systematic Theology in 1954. At that time, he then took the pastorate of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery and 15 or so months later became involved in the Montgomery bus boycott, which lasted approximately a year from late 55 to late 1956. In the wake of the boycott, Dr. King and several dozen other black Southern ministers formed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1957 and began a very gradual and at times very quiet effort to organize local movements across the South. And when the student protest effort began at the black colleges in 1960 with the sit-ins, and then also with the Freedom Rides that the Congress of Racial Equality sponsored in 1961, King stepped more and more to the forefront as the symbolic leader of the Southern black movement. Throughout the mid-60s, King and his colleagues in SCLC masterminded a series of protest campaigns, Albany, Georgia in 1962, Birmingham with its dogs and fire hoses in 63, St. Augustine, Florida in 64, and finally Selma, Alabama in 1965, which led to the Voting Rights Act. Dr. King was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize late in 1964, and then in 1966, with his own political vision broadening considerably, he took SCLC North to Chicago to lead an anti-racism campaign there, and in 1967 spoke out very strongly against American involvement in Vietnam. Finally, in the last year of his life, he began making plans for a large-scale poor people's campaign that would descend on Washington and which was in its final planning stages at the time that Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis on April 4th, 1968, where he had gone to lend support to a local sanitation strike.
David Garrow, does the fact that we now have a national holiday in honor of Martin Luther King, Jr., does that indicate that we have a national consensus about the importance of Martin Luther King, Jr. in American culture?
We may have a consensus about the importance of his impact and the movement's impact on American society. But in my estimation, even the passage of the holiday bill, and passage by a substantial margin, doesn't indicate that we really have a true national consensus about the positive value of King's role and King's life, because I think there still are many critics and many doubters.
Do you mean by that, for instance, that Congress may have acted on the holiday for fear of being criticized, of saying, well, we've got to do something? David Lewis, what do you think?
Yes, I think that one could say that there is a consensus about the political importance of commemorating and honoring the significance of Dr. King. But I agree with David. I think in two respects, the consensus is somewhat wanting. There is, I think, a considerable segment of the population that is still dubious about certain aspects of the personality of Dr. King, and even somewhat reserved about the methodology used to accomplish his ends. That is, people who believe that so much violence was occasioned by what was ostensibly a pacific representation of rights. But the other aspect of this is simply that I think the life is sufficiently rich that in our race and rush to memorialize him, we have begun to make him a sort of a marmoreal figure, and the human quality of King, the indispensable tertium quid which mobilized people and made them have confidence in his leadership, that is perhaps less clearly appreciated critically. No surprise there. So that this consensus is to some extent expedient, I think, and that isn't surprising. Mm-hmm. I think that the commemoration will lead, though, increasingly to a more sober and deeper appreciation of the meaning of the man.
All right, David Lewis and David Guerra, you have both written biographies of Martin Luther King, Jr. Why is Martin Luther King important? What did he do? How would you describe his contributions to American society?
From my point of view, they were both tactical and philosophical. It seems to me that King's ability to mobilize masses for peaceful constitutional changes in the society was unique. The context of American political and social change, there is always an element of violence, real or potential, especially when the issues involve race and class, and ultimately the redistribution of advantages, or at least the demand. And King was able, despite the violence that I mentioned earlier, that came as the necessary and inevitable side effect of nonviolent passive resistance, King was able generally to maintain a discipline and a faith in the ultimate rectitude of his ends, which were really, all in all, though profoundly impregnated with economic radicalism, all in all, were well within the compass of American social change and within a populist tradition, even. That certainly was one important, if and indeed unique, character heuristic of King's passage, the tactics. Philosophically, it was, I think, the melding or the meshing of morality with politics. I don't know that King ever cited Charles Peguy. He tended to run to Gandhi and Thoreau, but there was an expression which became the sort of leitmotif of French political action in at the turn of the last century, that the social revolution would be moral, or it wouldn't occur. And that certainly seems to have been the maxim or predicate of King's actions. And when one can realistically and convincingly talk about the great precepts and principles that should guide Judeo-Christian precepts and principles that should guide our conduct, and at the same time keep people either from glazing over, yawning, or going elsewhere, that's a knack. Mm-hmm. And he had until, I guess, Chicago, when things began measurably to unravel, the capacity to be credible in those terms.
David Guerra, let me ask you to elaborate on what David Lewis has been talking about. What moved the man? What inspired him?
I think the crucial experience in Dr. King's life, and the one that gave him the strength and the faith to go forward, and to go forward in a role that he was really quite uncomfortable with, was a vision, as he described it, that he had one night in the kitchen of his Montgomery parsonage, about 7-8 weeks into the bus boycott, where he felt that God came to him as an audible voice and told him to have courage and have strength and to go forward and to stand up for truth. He never advertised it or spoke freely about it. I know of two different occasions in church sermons, sermons where he was clearly in a very emotional state of mind, where he would talk about this.
Did he see himself as a prophet, for instance? What did he make of the experience in personal terms?
He saw himself as someone who had been given this mission, and given a mission that he didn't particularly want to have to take up, but a mission that he really couldn't avoid or run away from. And several people who were very close to him throughout those years will talk in private today of how only after Birmingham in 1963 did it seem that he stopped fighting this.
David Garrell, let me ask you to describe Martin Luther King Jr.'s ideological moorings. What kind of stuff did he read? Who were his heroes? What did he find convincing? What was he put off by?
In his school years at Boston University, the one element that had the greatest impact on Dr. King was simply the Hegelian dialectic.
David, let's just take a brief time out here. The Hegelian dialectic means?
As Dr. King appreciated it, the Hegelian dialectic was simply taking a synthesis from two opposites, finding a middle way. And that was a format that King learned reading Hegel in graduate school, and a format that he applied or used to resolve conflicts or decisions time and time again throughout the 1960s. And in many ways, it was a format that he institutionalized on his staff of forcing some people to take radical positions and pushing others, Andy Young most notably, to take relatively conservative positions.
Just to see what would come out of it.
Just as a method of debate and a method of consideration, and then himself taking the best elements from either extreme and combining them into a middle way.
He would shop for ideas then.
Oh, very much so.
All right. Well, I ask you this because some popular conceptions have it that he was very much a rigid thinker, that he was a Marxist, that all these labels fly around and get attached. I want to get behind that.
Well, I think couldn't be more askew. The first point about rigidity of thought, absolutely not. In fact, I think that he might have been faulted for his for want of a better word, flexibility. Mm-hmm. That is, and sometimes that reflected itself in indecision at critical moments. Later on, he tightened up. No, I would not have thought that he was in any way dogmatic or inflexible.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a discussion about the life and legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. The Soundings panelists are two of Dr. King's biographers, David Garrow and David Levering Lewis. David Garrow's forthcoming biography of Martin Luther King Jr. is a comprehensive chronicle of Dr. King's life between 1955 and the time of his assassination in Memphis in 1968. Professor Garrow is the author of two other books about Dr. King, Protest at Selma and the FBI and Martin Luther King Jr. David Levering Lewis wrote a biography of Dr. King that appeared in 1970. Professor Lewis is the author of books about the District of Columbia and Harlem. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, David Lewis worked on a research project about Ethiopia, Africa, and the Upper Nile at the end of the 19th century. Here is David Garrow.
I think that the most important thing about Dr. King's position, certainly at the beginning of his career in the late 1950s, was that he symbolized a mass action protest approach to black political efforts that was in line with the tradition of A. Philip Randolph.
Now, wait a minute. Philip Randolph? Give me a footnote there.
Phil Randolph was a longtime black labor leader, head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, a man with socialist political views that went back to the 20s, and who in the early 40s had proposed an initial March on Washington as a pressure method against Franklin Roosevelt, and who indeed, through Bayard Rustin, who was a very close associate of Mr. Randolph's, was really the father of the 1963 March on Washington. King in the late 1950s really symbolized this mass action, you know, people at the grassroots operating for themselves approach to black protest that came out of the Randolph tradition and that stood in very sharp contrast to the legal-oriented, more elitist approach that was exemplified by the NAACP. And Roy Wilkins.
In other words, Jim Crow. Is that too harsh an expression for?
Yes, I think so. I think my reading would be that the distinction is that the NAACP was, and its cohort were composed of people who already had one or two legs up on the rung of social mobility and who believed that the next rung would come slowly, gradually, and largely through litigation, through the courts, and through lobbying on Capitol Hill, sympathetic Congress persons, through networks of important people, well-bred people, people who understood how terrible the society would become if there weren't some change.
Well, does this make of Martin Luther King Jr. an impatient kind of social activist? Could you use that word to describe him, David Garrell?
I don't think you could describe him as any more impatient than, say, the NAACP cohort. But I think that there was a very different ideological underpinning to the sort of Randolph, Rustin, King approach as of the late 1950s, and what Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP, and Thurgood Marshall, at that time the NAACP legal chief, were talking about. Wilkins and Marshall very strongly believed that real change would come through filing court suits and saw the sort of mass bus boycott, mass sit-ins as being sort of ineffectual window dressing.
Well, even more than that, they would cause a rising of the temperature in the society that would make litigation less and less fruitful. They would polarize the society, and they would bring out the lunatic fringe on all sides. And so they wanted rather an equable social terrain over which to march with court briefs and with lobbying tactics.
In other words, more middle of the road.
More middle of the road. If they were impatient, the NAACP people seem to have been impatient for advantages for the white collar skin in the Afro-American community, and King expressed the impatience of all those people who were not white collar and weren't going to be white collar in the foreseeable future, no matter what the social changes, but who at least could have minimal constitutional guarantees and minimal access to the workplace.
David Lewis, David Garrell, we began our discussion with reference to the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Let's conclude with comments from both of you about King's critics. David Garrell?
I think the criticisms of King, both the criticisms that were made during the holiday bill and the criticisms that have been made in other contexts, fall perhaps in three categories. First, this whole debate that goes back 20 years about was the movement somehow communist influenced? Was King subject to communist influence? And the record, I think, there is very clear, even if some people choose to ignore it, that there is no evidence at all that King was the puppet or the tool of anyone, or indeed that any of his advisors, even Stanley Levison, the most controversial figure, was speaking for subversive or communist elements during the time of his relationship with King. Second, there's the question that conservatives have raised, and raise with some accurate basis, in fact, as to whether King's ideology and King's criticisms of American foreign policy in the late 60s and his criticisms of American economic injustice were so left or so radical as to make King undeserving of a national honor such as the Birthday Bill. And one, I think, simply has to look from the perspective of one's own individual ideology in weighing the attractiveness or the unattractiveness of those ideological criticisms. Third, and this is something that has been talked about many times over the years, is the question of Dr. King's private life, and that people repeatedly have alluded to in trying to criticize or devalue him. And I think that particularly the Holiday Bill debate featured the application of a very blatant standard, a standard which really was trying to focus in on King's private life and use that as the subject matter for a public discussion in a way that never has been done with the private lives of other major American political figures, be it presidents of recent vintage, Johnson, Kennedy, Roosevelt, or be it the Founding Fathers and their personal failings.
David Lewis?
I think David has in his three-part disquisition really done the job here. There is another aspect of the criticism, and I think it has to do with residual racism. I think we do have to confront that. King represents a quantum leap in imagery, just as, say, Jesse Jackson represents another quantum leap in ethnic or racial imagery. And we all have assumptions and presumptions about the appropriate conduct, collective and personal, of groups of individuals and groups. King didn't fit that. Jackson doesn't fit that. And so there's a certain shock, a certain lag, a certain questioning, which is not always invidious, but in fact simply coming out of the psychology of the culture. George Washington and Martin Luther King, where's Jefferson? Where's Robert E. Lee? And those are not questions that are undeserving of our attention. And to the extent that they were legitimately raised and not raised in the out of the mean-spirited motives of, say, a Jesse Helms, to that extent they should be seriously entertained. There's that. What's curious, though, about the criticism to the private life of Martin Luther King is that he himself, I think, was quite aware of the much of the surveillance that David refers to. And he had the choice of being very careful and not being vulnerable to the FBI smear campaign, or of not being careful. He chose not to be careful. And that says a great deal about whatever the truth and veracity of the sort of priapic and missionary position private life of Dr. King, a great deal about the courage of the man, in the sense that what was important was, after all, a movement, civil rights, human rights. And to bedevil himself with electronic surveillance and olives in cocktail glasses that were electrified throughout the country was, in fact, an absurdity. He saw the absurdity of it from a purist point of view. He was an enormously human figure. Mm-hmm.
David Garrow, I'm going to give you the last word. Your book on King will be out shortly. Why is he important?
Dr. King's primary role for the civil rights movement in the 60s was as a symbolic figure, as a representative or a representation of what this much larger grassroots movement was all about. And King, in a very straightforward and very succinct manner, put across to white America what the black movement in the South was saying. Now, I think the one thing, perhaps more important than anything else, that has happened since Dr. King's death is that much of America has come to view him as a successful and indeed reassuring reform figure, someone who led the effort to eliminate segregation and legal discrimination from American life. However, I think oftentimes people are unaware, and oftentimes just aren't given the true picture of the latter part of King's life, where he had become very deeply and strongly convinced that the movement had to go beyond simply attacking segregation and racial discrimination and raising questions about the distribution of economic wealth and economic power in America. And that broadening of King's vision, and the fact that in the last few years of his life he did not find any successful way to pursue or implement that vision, left him at the time of his assassination rather pessimistic and indeed rather cynical about American society and the likelihood of meaningful changes. And I think that the complete picture of King's life leaves you with a much more mixed message about the story of the 60s than one gets only if one looks at I Have a Dream or the passage of statutes like the 64 Civil Rights Act and the 65 Voting Rights Act. While everyone knows the I Have a Dream oration and has heard that on radio or television any number of times, most people, I believe, are unaware of the fact that King, throughout the last few years of his life, in speech after speech, would talk about how the dream he had had in Washington in 1963 had become for him a nightmare. He had come to believe, really, that for poor people, not just poor black people, but poor people of all races and colors, that simply eliminating legal discrimination, social discrimination, was not going to tangibly change their lives until you could come up with some alteration in the structure of economic power. And that was the mission, the unfulfilled mission, that he had in mind at the end of his own life, and which unfortunately has been a mission that no one else has stepped forward to tackle in any meaningful or successful way since the time of Dr. King's death.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about the life and legacy of Martin Luther King, Jr. This program is the first in a series of Soundings discussions in recognition of Black History Month, February 1985. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about Marcus Garvey, the black cultural and political leader who created the Universal Negro Improvement Association. My guest will be Robert Hill, a professor of history at the University of California at Los Angeles. Professor Hill is the editor of the Marcus Garvey Papers and the author of a forthcoming biography of Marcus Garvey. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for the first in a series of discussions recognizing Black History Month, February 1985. This week, Soundings presents a conversation about the life and legacy of Martin Luther King, Jr., whose personal ministry and social activism ended with his assassination in Memphis in 1968, but whose influence continues as a vital force in American life. The Soundings panelists are two biographers of Martin Luther King, Jr., David Garrow of the City College of New York and David Levering Lewis of Howard University. The life and legacy of Martin Luther King, Jr., this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.